Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Chris Tensing, editor of Middle East Report, who takes a closer look at what triggered the anger and violence in the Muslim world in response to the circulation of an anti-Islamic film trailer. Marjorie Cohen, professor of law and past president of the National Lawyers Guild, who talks about a federal court ruling that challenges the government's right to indefinitely detain terrorist suspects and those accused of supporting terrorism. And Anne Wright, a retired colonel in the U.S. Army Reserves turned peace activist, who discusses the challenges facing the Occupy Wall Street movement as activists celebrated their one-year anniversary in New York City. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After 50 years of military rule and isolation, Myanmar, the nation formerly known as Burma, in a step toward economic reform, granted MasterCard a license to operate in the Southeast Asian country. It may be a sign of things to come, as some of the world's largest banks and insurance companies, like Citibank, wait in line to do business in Myanmar, a nation of 60 million mostly poor people. Telecom and energy interests are also exploring the prospects of investing in Myanmar after 15 years of Western economic sanctions imposed to counter the military's repression of the democracy movement led by Aung San Suu Kyi. Still, Burmese civil society insists broad social reforms are required before the flood of foreign investment arrives. They advocate for investment in services like electricity, healthcare, education, improved public transit, and land reform. Human rights activists are fearful foreign companies investing in the energy and mining sector will make deals with those responsible for past rights abuses under military rule, including the widespread use of forced labor. Many activists are also opposed to any Western investment deals involving the state-owned Myanmar oil and gas enterprise, as it has been linked to massive corruption. Over the summer, the Obama administration put new conditions on U.S. companies moving to invest in Myanmar. However, Jennifer Quigley of the U.S. campaign in Burma called the new investment rules inadequate, declaring there's no probation on the Myanmar military's ability to go and clear out villages to use as forced labor in the name of foreign investment. Along the bustling streets of Santiago, Chile, a McDonald's outlet stands out with wall-sized posters of ice cream cones, hamburgers, and promises of toys tucked into children's meals. However, in response to a growing obesity problem, Chilean Senator Guido Girardi wants to ban the cartoon figures and other marketing ploys that attract children and their parents. Girardi has filed a complaint against McDonald's, Burger King, and Kentucky Fried Chicken restaurants operating in Chile for their use of stickers, games, and other devices to appeal to children. According to the Christian Science Monitor, nearly one quarter of Chile's population is now classified as obese, a rate similar to Britain. Other newly middle-income nations like Brazil, Mexico, and China have also experienced an obesity crisis along with chronic diseases like diabetes and heart disease. Across the globe, it is estimated that 1.5 billion adults are now obese. Mexico, the largest consumer of Coca-Cola on Earth, now has 70% of its adult population considered overweight or obese. This is also true for over 25% of Mexican children between the ages of 5 and 11. In response to the surge in obesity levels, the Mexican government recently launched its obesity prevention strategy, which includes a ban on soda sold in public schools. Global nutrition researcher Barry Popkin of the University of North Carolina blames much of the obesity crisis on global food and beverage giants attracted by growing incomes in countries like Brazil and China. While some government leaders are beginning to confront the causes of obesity, Popkin warns that the food industry is just too powerful. In early April, a group of self-declared white border vigilantes, wearing camouflage, opened fire on a truck carrying undocumented immigrants just north of the Mexican border near Eloy, Arizona. Two migrants died in the attack. According to the Southern Poverty Law Center, the April killings of migrants crossing the Sonora Desert were similar to murders in 2007, which prompted a Department of Homeland Security investigation. In recent months, white separatists and neo-Nazis have been apprehended placing pipe bombs along the border, targeting arriving immigrants. In May, neo-Nazi activist J.T. Reddy murdered a Latino family in suburban Phoenix before shooting himself. In early 2011, Reddy recruited another man, Jeffrey Harbin, who was later arrested for carrying three homemade bombs. Also in 2011, U.S. Border Control agents found Reddy detaining Mexican migrants in the desert by pointing a gun at a group which had crossed the border. Reddy could have faced criminal charges for engaging in false imprisonment, but federal prosecutors declined to press charges. Law enforcement in Arizona has attributed all non-weather-related deaths of migrants in the Sonoran Desert to drug gangs or human smugglers, ignoring the possible involvement of white supremacist and vigilante groups. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
On the date that marked the 11th year since the 2001 al-Qaeda terrorist attacks on New York City and Washington, D.C., U.S. Ambassador to Libya Chris Stevens, along with three other Americans, were killed when militants attacked the U.S. consulate in the eastern Libyan city of Benghazi. The protests in Libya and elsewhere that led to the assault on the U.S. Benghazi diplomatic compound were provoked by anger at a crude online film trailer that mocks and insults Islam's holiest prophet, Muhammad. The filmmaker appears to be a Coptic Christian man living in the U.S. who has a felony criminal conviction for bank fraud. Protests in reaction to the film, sometimes violent, have spread across the Muslim world to dozens of cities in some 20 nations. To many Americans, the media images of angry street protests are hard to comprehend, given that the U.S. government had no official or unofficial connection to the marginal figure who made the amateur film. Although the anti-film protests are relatively small in most nations, many observers of the Arab and Muslim world point out that militant religious leaders succeed in mobilizing anger toward the U.S. based on decades of Washington's policies supporting brutal dictatorships across the Middle East and North Africa, support for Israel at the expense of human rights for the Palestinian people, and U.S. wars and drone attacks that have victimized thousands of civilians. Your reporter spoke with Chris Tensing, editor of Middle East Report, who places the current anti-American protests in the context of long-standing grievances against the U.S. and the much larger outpouring of support for democracy during the Arab Spring uprisings across the region last year.
These protests, as numerous as they have been and as widespread as they have been, were absolutely dwarfed by the pro-democracy uprisings that occurred across the Arab world beginning in December of 2010 and going through 2011. Those were truly mass protests that brought out the full cross-section of Egyptian and Tunisian and Yemeni society. And these protests, by contrast, certainly they are vigorous and the people participating are very passionate about what they're protesting, but they're in the thousands, whereas the demonstrations against dictatorship were in the millions. And these protests tend to be limited to, at the very least, ultra-conservative Islamists, if not radical Islamists, who have some pretty non-mainstream ideas about what their society should look like and what Islam is and what it represents in the life of an individual Muslim. So in that sense, these protests are not representative. I do think, however, that there just simply is a disconnect between the Muslim world and the West in terms of issues of freedom of speech and where the red lines are and whether it is possible to talk about religion and the holy scriptures of various religions and so on. And for the vast majority of Muslims, including those who are absolutely appalled by the violence that has attended these protests in some places and are even embarrassed by the fact of the protests, they still are offended by this stupid film, and they often do not understand why the U.S. government, for example, is not able to ban the film, has shown no interest in doing so. There is a disconnect between our, you know, First Amendment absolutism, as far as it goes, and in even some European countries, which have stricter laws than we do about what can and cannot be said about sensitive topics. So I do think that factor is there. But this film, we have to remember, it happens against a backdrop of decades of U.S. and, if you want to go back to the colonial period, Western policies, which have made it easy for radical Islamists of the stripe who are eagerly broadcasting this video in Egypt, for example, to rile people up. it makes it easy for these demagogues, which is what they are, to convince poorly educated people that this film is of a piece with a campaign against Islam and Muslims and the Muslim world. And one can cite any number of policies, whether in very recent times, the drone strikes and other things associated with the war on terrorism. One can cite the Iraq War. One can cite the increasingly unstinting support of the U.S. for Israel, even as it gobbles up more and more Palestinian land that's supposed to be part of a Palestinian state. And one can cite also the longstanding U.S. support for the same dictators that those protests in the last year and a half overthrew. So it's, you know, because of these policies and because of this long history, it's unfortunately not hard for demagogues among the radical Islamist trend to propagate the message that this silly video is part of a war on Islam.
Do Americans, by watching and reading American media, have a sense of that history that feeds into the demagogues, as you describe them, and how easy it is to tap that anger?
I think no, because I don't know what it is. Our media just has very short memories. I mean, it wasn't so long ago, you know, that in the wake of the September 11th attacks that, you know, eventually we did get some fairly reasoned mainstream media coverage of this history, and the media did a decent job, not a fantastic job, but a decent job of reporting on the U.S. support for, say, Ben Ali in Tunisia and Mubarak and in Egypt at the time of the Arab revolts. But yet I think we can look at a couple of quite prominent examples from the last week. There was an article in the New York Times about the U.S. position in the Middle East amidst all of these embassy riots, which did not see fit to mention much of the policy background that I mentioned. And then we've just had this Newsweek cover come out when the cover says Muslim Rage, and they recruited Ayaan Hirsi Ali, a notorious anti-Islam activist and propagandist, to write the cover story, and her husband Neil Ferguson also has a piece about how Obama is a pusillanimous appeaser of radical Muslims, and you know, so there's all of that context is quite missing, and instead there is a picture of these protesters and Muslims writ large as being irrational, Quran-wielding fanatics, which, of course, you know, that image is an old one in the Western imagination. Unfortunately, of course, there are some people in the region who embody that image, but for the vast majority of people are not like that. And it's sad on so many levels, you know, to see these same old racist and Orientalist tropes keep coming up, and it's sad to see the radicals in the region doing all they can to reinforce them.
That was Chris Tensing, editor of Middle East Report. Find more analysis and commentary on issues roiling the Middle East on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Ever since President Obama signed the 2012 National Defense Authorization Act on December 31, 2011, civil liberties activists have raised the alarm about several of the legislation's provisions. Section 1021 of the NDAA empowers the current and all future presidents to indefinitely imprison U.S. citizens and non-citizens who were part of or substantially supported al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or associated forces that are engaged in hostilities against the United States or its coalition partners. Persons accused under this provision can be held by the U.S. military indefinitely or transferred to any nation in the world without charge, trial, or access to an attorney. However, a federal judge struck down the provision in a September 12th ruling, acting in a lawsuit filed on behalf of seven plaintiffs challenging the legality of what they assert are unconstitutional provisions in the NDAA. Plaintiffs in the case, known as Hedges v. Obama, include former New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges, Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, and America's best-known progressive dissident and linguist Noam Chomsky. United States District Court Judge Catherine B. Forrest blocked enforcement of the indefinite detention provision of the NDAA, claiming it was too vague and would have a chilling effect on free speech. The Obama administration responded by filing an emergency appeal of the ruling and succeeded in convincing a New York federal judge to temporarily block Judge Forrest's decision. Your reporter spoke with Marjorie Cohn, professor of law and past president of the National Lawyers Guild, who talks about Judge Forrest's ruling and what's at stake for civil liberties in this legal dispute which may eventually make its way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
In the National Defense Authorization Act, the Congress expanded the group of people who could be indefinitely detained to include not just people who perpetrated the September 11th attacks, but also anyone who is part of or substantially supports Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or associated forces engaged in hostilities against the U.S. or its allies. And there are seven plaintiffs who brought a lawsuit saying that this was unconstitutional because it could apply to U.S. citizens, it could apply to people who are, to journalists who are interviewing people, maybe the Taliban or people who share the Taliban's goals. Now, during the hearing in front of Judge Forrest on the constitutionality of this section, she asked the Obama lawyers, and Obama is supporting this particular provision, even though he signed a signing statement, which he attached to his signing of the bill, saying, I'm not going to indefinitely detain U.S. citizens. But when Judge Forrest asked the Obama lawyers whether it would apply to U.S. citizens, whether U.S. citizens could be indefinitely detained under this section, they couldn't say. They wouldn't say. And when Judge Forrest asked the Obama lawyers, well, could this section punish the author of a book that didn't say how to make a bomb, but rather simply expressed support for the political goals of the Taliban or made the case that the Taliban's view that the U.S. government overreaches in occupying other countries is correct, could that person be indefinitely detained? The Obama administration couldn't say. Judge Forrest asked the Obama lawyers, exactly what does material support or substantially support mean? What's the difference between direct and indirect support? They couldn't say. So she ultimately ruled that this provision violates the Fifth Amendment, which requires due process. Somebody needs to be arrested and charged with a crime, not just locked up the rest of their lives, and that it also violates the First Amendment because it's unconstitutionally overbroad. That means that it would punish lawful activity, not just unlawful activity.
Now, one of the other things that is a big element in this decision from Judge Catherine Forrest was the congressional legislation passed shortly after the September 2001 terrorist attacks in Manhattan and Washington, D.C., and that is the authorization for the use of military force. The Bush administration used the congressional authorization for the use of military force to launch any number of attacks and violations, in the view of many, of American citizens' civil liberties. The Obama administration seems to continue to rely on that piece of legislation passed shortly after the terrorist attacks. Do you want to comment on the solid ground or lack of solid ground that legislation stands on now after Catherine Forrest ruled on this in the federal court?
Yes, the authorization for the use of military force said that the president could order military action against the people responsible for the 9/11 attacks. But this has been used by Bush and now Obama to go way beyond that, to talk about suspected terrorists or people who are associated with terrorists or give material support, which goes way beyond the intention of the authorization for the use of military force.
Marjorie, what's at stake in this case now that the Obama administration has filed an emergency appeal of Judge Forrest's decision, really disallowing the indefinite detention of suspected terrorists? We've had certainly a lot of concern over the years since 9/11 about the dramatic erosion of civil liberties in this country and the undermining of the U.S. Bill of Rights. What should people be looking at here in terms of this case and where it goes?
Well, people should be looking at where it ends up. Does it end up in the appeals court or in the Supreme Court? And will they allow indefinite detention of people, anybody, and even U.S. citizens as well? The United States has ratified the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which is a treaty, therefore makes it part of the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, part of U.S. law under the Supremacy Clause. And that says no arbitrary detention. It requires due process. It requires that people be told of the charges against them and given a fair trial. And this provision of the National Defense Authorization Act violates the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. Now, whether the highest court to hear this appeal will agree with that, will agree that it's unconstitutional, remains to be seen. But if it stands, then this administration or the next administration could theoretically indefinitely detain U.S. citizens forever without criminal charges for allegedly providing substantial support to forces associated with these terrorist organizations. And it means that it's going to chill our right to dissent, chill our rights to speak out against government policies.
That was Marjorie Cohn, a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and past president of the National Lawyers Guild. Learn more about the civil liberties issues involved in the government's power of indefinite detention by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. An estimated 1,000 activists gathered September 17th in Lower Manhattan to celebrate the one-year anniversary of Occupy Wall Street, which began with a handful of protesters camping out in Zuccotti Park, not far from the New York Stock Exchange. The New York City protest later blossomed into a global movement against economic inequality and unchecked corporate power, with occupations in more than 600 communities in the U.S. and nearly 100 abroad. Those involved in Occupy are fighting for a bottom-up egalitarian society where the goal is not profit, but community. Marking the anniversary, activists snake through the streets of the financial district, engaging in nonviolent civil disobedience to block business as usual. At the end of the day, police had arrested 185. Throughout the evening of September 17th, activists rallied in several city parks to discuss next steps for the movement, which many in the corporate media have declared dead. Just as the actions were getting underway on September 17th, Between the Lines Melinda Tuhu spoke with peace activist Anne Wright about her views of the Occupy movement. Wright was a retired U.S. Army colonel and an active-duty diplomat when she resigned her post in 2003 to protest the war in Iraq. She now works with many activist groups, including Veterans for Peace and Code Pink Women for Peace. Here she discusses the dilemma Occupy activists have grappled with in holding public space, the relevance of electoral politics, and the issues of U.S. foreign policy and war and peace.
Yeah, well, it's great to get all sorts of people back together again right here where for a year ago a movement was started to challenge the economic system of the United States, the graft and corruption of Wall Street. And I'm pleased to be back here. Over the course of the year, I've visited 35 Occupies all over the country as I speak about on my speaking tours on foreign policy. And so I was dropping in on all the Occupies in places where I was. So you know, it's a wonderful group of people in virtually every community in the country who want to challenge this system that we have, that the rich get richer and the poor drown.
So when you visited some of those places, What did you find? Like, I'm from New Haven, and we had an occupation that lasted 6 months on the New Haven Green, and unfortunately, it really turned into just holding the ground, and people were doing that, and they really weren't doing much outreach in the community, and they really, unfortunately, alienated a lot of people that had started out supporting them, and they said, well, what are you doing?
I think that's one of the challenges of all the Occupies, where the holding of the ground became the focal point rather than continuing working the issues, and that's why for the good movements that have been around, they didn't let the fact that the cops threw them out, the city council said tear down these stinky little tents. They just said, forget it. You know, the ground is not important. It's what we're doing with all these new people that have come out to be citizen activists. It's one of the things, you know, now here we're a year later, we understand that holding ground is not the most important thing, but it's the community outreach. It's going to foreclosure court hearings to try to get the courts to stop these foreclosures. It's to try to hold accountable Bank of America and all of the big banks for these predatory lending practices. It's to challenge NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act. Those are the things we really need to be focusing on.
One other thing, in terms of the work that you've been dedicated to, the anti-war work, it seems like you don't hear much about that around Occupy.
Yeah, the anti-war part of it was not the real focus of the initial part, but as anti-war people were a part of Occupy, they kept talking about how the economic system is protecting the military-industrial complex, and that's huge chunks of our money that should be going to social justice issues are being sucked up by, you know, military stuff. So that I think has been woven more into it now. But by far the overwhelming look from Occupy was at, as its name implies, Wall Street and the horrible abuses that Wall Street's been able to get away with.
What do you think about the fact that I guess the Tea Party was able to elect 87 freshman members of Congress, you know, 2 years ago, and that they're looking to maybe get more in now, and there hasn't, I mean, except for maybe Elizabeth Warren, there seems to be a real disconnect between Occupy groups and electoral politics. Like, they don't believe in electoral politics almost. Yeah. Do you think that's a problem?
Well, yeah. If you want political change through the current system that we have, then you know, the Tea Party model of getting big bucks, that you get a lot of big, rich Republicans to give a lot of money to an organization, in this case called the Tea Party, that's then divvied out to candidates that are running so that they really have a ready-made political organization that they just pop right into. Whereas this is definitely a grassroots movement that does not have any big, thank God, it doesn't have any big political backers. They very specifically, the Occupy movement has told the Democratic Party to take a hike, as it has told the Republican Party, and it's not interested in getting involved in politics. It's interested in raising Cane about the issues and almost leaving it to whomever else wants to pick up the political side of it. And if you see the Green Party, that's I think stronger this year. You see the Peace and Justice Party that's now formed, that Rocky Anderson is the presidential candidate. But most people that are involved in Wall Street, the Occupy Wall Street, say, I don't want to be a part of that. And there are plenty of Americans that can pick that thing up, and we don't have to do it all. And we see that sometimes motivation and enthusiasm by those who are not doing anything, it's hard to get them to do something. And so that part of it really hasn't moved very far. But it's not up to these people to do it. They shouldn't have to do everything. It's up to anybody that thinks the system ought to change. You know, you need to pick out your part of this thing and start working on it.
That was Ann Wright, a retired colonel in the U.S. Army Reserves, who resigned from the U.S. Foreign Service in protest of the Iraq War in March 2003. Learn more about the Occupy Wall Street movement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.